Mahshid turned to Azin and said with quiet disdain, "No one was talking about making a choice between adultery and hypocrisy. The point is, do we have any morality at all? Do we consider that anything goes, that we have no responsibility towards others, but only for satisfying our needs?" "Well, that is the crux of the great novels," Mona added, "like Madame Bovary or Anna Karenina or James's, for that matter. The question of doing what is right or what we want to do." "And what if we say that it is right to do what we want to do, and not what society or some authority figure tells us to do?" said Nasreen, this time without bothering to lift her head from her notebook. There was something in the air that day that did not relate directly to the books we had read. Our discussion had plunged us into more personal and private arenas, and my girls found that they could not resolve their own dilemmas quite as neatly as they could in the case of Emma Bovary or Lolita. Azin had bent forward, her long gold earrings playing hide-and-seek in the ringlets of her hair. "We need to be honest with ourselves," she said. "I mean, that is the first condition. As women, do we have the same right as men to enjoy sex? How many of us would say, yes, we do have a right. We have an equal right to enjoy sex, and if our husbands don't satisfy us, then we have a right to seek satisfaction elsewhere." She tried to make her point as casually as possible, but she had managed to surprise us all. Azin is the tallest one in our group, the one with the blonde hair and milky skin. She would often bite the corner of her lower lip and launch into tirades about love, sex, and men, like a child throwing a big stone into the pool, not just to make a splash, but to wet the adults in the bargain. Azin had been married 3 times, most recently to a good-looking and rich merchant from a traditional provincial Bazari family. I had seen her husband at many of my conferences and meetings, which were usually attended by my girls. He seemed very proud of her and always treated me with exaggerated deference. At every meeting, he made sure I was comfortable. If there was no water at the podium, he would see to it that the mistake was rectified. If extra chairs were needed, he would boss the staff around. Somehow at these meetings, it seemed that he was the gracious host, who had granted us his space, his time, because that was all he had to give. I was sure that Azin's assault had been partly directed against Mahshid, and perhaps indirectly against Mana, too. Their clashes were not only the result of their different backgrounds. Azin's outbursts, her seeming frankness about her personal life and desires, made Mana and Mahshid, both reserved by temperament, deeply uncomfortable. They disapproved of her, and Azin sensed that. Her efforts at friendship were rejected as hypocritical. Mahshid's response, as usual, was silence. She drew into herself and refused to fill the void that Azin's question had left behind. Her silence extended to the others and was broken finally by a short giggle from Yasi. I thought this was a good time for a break and went to the kitchen to bring in the tea. When I returned, I heard Yasi laughing. Trying to lighten the mood, she was saying, "How could God be so cruel as to create a Muslim woman with so much flesh and so little sex appeal?" She turned toward Mahshid and stared at her in mock horror. Mahshid looked down and then shyly and royally lifted her head, her slanted eyes widening in an indulgent smile. "You don't need sex appeal," she told Yasi. But Yasi wouldn't give up. "Laugh, please laugh," she implored Mahshid. "Dr. Nafisi, please command her to laugh." And Mahshid's attempt at laughter was drowned out by the others' less guarded hilarity. There was a pause and a silence as I placed the tray of tea on the table. Nasreen suddenly said, "I know what it means to be caught between tradition and change. I've been in the middle of it all my life. She seated herself on the arm of Mahshid's chair, while Mahshid did her best to drink her tea and keep it from coming into collision with Nasreen, whose expressive hands, moving in all directions, came precariously close to knocking the teacup over several times. "I know it firsthand," Nasreen said. "My mother came from a wealthy, secular and modern family. She was the only daughter, had two brothers, both of whom had chosen a diplomatic career. My grandfather was very liberal, and he wanted her to finish her education and go to college. He sent her to the American school." "The American school?" echoed Sanaz, her hand lovingly playing with her hair. "Yes, in those days, most girls didn't even finish high school, never mind going to the American school. And my mother could speak English and French." Nasreen sounded rather pleased and proud of this fact. "But then what did she do?" "She fell in love with my father, her tutor. She was terrible in math and science." "It's ironic," said Nasreen again, lifting her hand dangerously close to Mahshid's cup. "They thought my father, coming from a religious background, would be safe with a young girl like my mother. And anyway, who would have thought that a modern young woman like her would be interested in a stern young man who seldom smiled, never looked her in the eyes, and whose sisters and mother all wore the chador? But she fell for him, perhaps because he was so different. Perhaps because for her, wearing the chador and caring for him seemed more romantic than going to some college and becoming a lady doctor or whatever. She said she never regretted it, her marriage. But she always talked about her American school, her old high school friends whom she never saw again after her marriage. And she taught me English. When I was a kid, she used to teach me the ABCs, and then she bought me English books. I never had trouble with English, thanks to her, nor did my sister, who was much older than me by 9 years. Rather strange for a Muslim woman. I mean, she should have taught us Arabic, but she never learned the language. My sister married someone, quote, unquote, Nasreen made a large quotation mark with her hands, modern, and went to live in England. We only see them when they come home for vacations. The time for break was over, but Nasreen's story had drawn us in, and even Azin and Mahshid seemed to have come to a temporary truce. When Mahshid stretched her hand to pick a cream puff, Azin handed the dish over to her with a friendly smile, forcing a gracious thank you. "My mother remained faithful to my dad. She changed her whole life for him and never really complained," Nasreen continued. "His only concession was that he let her make us weird food, fancy French food, my father would call it. All fancy food for him was French. Although we were brought up according to my dad's dictates, my mother's family and her past were always in the shadows, hinting at another way of life. It wasn't just that my mother could never get along with my father's family, who considered her uppity and an outsider. She's very lonely, my mother is. Sometimes I think I wish she would commit adultery or something." Mahshid looked up at her, startled. And Nasreen got up and laughed. "Well," she said, "or something." Nasreen's story and the confrontation between Azin and Mahshid had changed our mood too much for us to return to our class discussion. We ended up making desultory conversation, mainly gossiping about our experiences at the university until we broke up. When the girls left that afternoon, they left behind the aura of their unsolved problems and dilemmas. I felt exhausted. I chose the only way I knew to cope with problems. I went to the refrigerator, scooped up the coffee ice cream, poured some cold coffee over it, looked for walnuts, discovered we had none left, went after almonds, crushed them with my teeth, and sprinkled them over my concoction. I knew that Azin's outrageousness was partly defensive, that it was her way of overcoming Mahshid's and Mana's defenses. Mahshid thought Azin was dismissive of her traditional background, her thick, dark scarves, her old maidenish ways. She didn't know how effective her own contemptuous silences could be. Small and dainty, with her cameo brooches, she did actually wear cameo brooches, her small earrings, pale blue blouses buttoned up to the neck and her pale smiles, Mahshid was a formidable enemy. Did she and Mana know how their obstinate silences, their cold, immaculate disapproval affected Azin, made her defenseless? In one of their confrontations during the break, I had heard Mahshid telling Azin, "Yes, you have your sexual experiences and your admirers. You are not an old maid like me. Yes, old maid. I don't have a rich husband, and I don't drive a car, but you still have no right to disrespect me." When Azin complained, "But how? How was I disrespectful?" Mahshid had turned around and left her there with a smile like cold leftovers. No amount of talk and discussion on my part, both in class and with each of them in private, had helped matters between them. Their only concession had been to try and leave each other alone inside the class. Not very malleable, as Yasi might say. 16. Is this how it all started? Was it the day we were sitting at his dining room table, greedily biting into our forbidden ham and cheese sandwich and calling it a croque monsieur? At some point, we must have caught the same expression of ravenous and adulterated pleasure in each other's eyes because we started to laugh simultaneously. I raised my glass of water to him and said, "Who would have thought that such a simple meal would appear to us like a kingly feast?" And he said, "We must thank the Islamic Republic for making us rediscover and even covet all these things we took for granted. One could write a paper on the pleasure of eating a ham sandwich." And I said, "Oh, the things we have to be thankful for." And that memorable day was the beginning of our detailing our long list of debts to the Islamic Republic. Parties, eating ice cream in public, falling in love, holding hands, wearing lipstick, laughing in public and reading Lolita in Tehran. We sometimes met on a corner of the wide leafy boulevard leading to the mountains for our afternoon walks. I used to wonder what the Revolutionary Committee would think of these meetings. Would they suspect us of political conspiracy or of a lover's rendezvous? It was encouraging in a strange way that they would perhaps never guess the real purpose of our encounters. Was not life exciting when every simple act acquired the complexity of a dangerous secret mission? We always had something to exchange. Books, articles, tapes, boxes of chocolate he received from Switzerland, for chocolates were expensive, especially ones from Switzerland. He brought me videos of rare films, which my children and I, and later my students and I, would watch. A Night at the Opera, Casablanca, The Pirate, Johnny Guitar. My magician used to say he could tell a great deal about people from their photographs, especially the angle of their noses. After some hesitation, I brought him some photographs of my girls, anxiously awaiting his pronouncement. He would hold one in his hand, scrutinize it from different perspectives, and issue a short statement. I wanted him to read their writings and to look at their drawings right there and then. I wanted to know what he thought. "They are fine people," he said, looking at me with the ironic smile of an indulgent father. "Fine? Fine people? I wanted him to say that they were geniuses, although I was glad to be assured of their fineness. Two of them, he thought, could make something of their writings. Shall I bring them to you? Will you meet with them? No, he was trying to get rid of people, not add to his acquaintances. 17. Cincinnatus C., the hero of invitation to a beheading, talks of a rare kind of time, the pause, hiatus, when the heart is like a feather. Part of my thoughts is always crowding around the invisible umbilical cord that joins this world to something, to what I shall not say yet. Cincinnatus's release by his jailers depends on his discovery of this invisible cord deep inside himself that joins him to another world so that he can finally escape the staged and fake world of his executioners. In his preface to Bent Sinister, Nabokov describes a similar link to another world, a puddle that appears to Krug, his fictional hero, at various points in the novel. He calls it a rent in his world leading to another world of tenderness, brightness, and beauty. I think in some ways our readings and discussions of the novels in that class became our moment of pause, our link to that other world of tenderness, brightness, and beauty. Only eventually we were compelled to return. During the break one morning, while we were enjoying our coffee and pastries, Mitra began to tell us how she felt as she climbed up the stairs every Thursday morning. She said that step by step, she could feel herself gradually leaving reality behind her, leaving the dark, dank cell she lived in to surface for a few hours into open air and sunshine. Then, when it was over, she returned to herself. At the time, I felt this was a point against the class, as if it should somehow guarantee open air and sunshine beyond its confines. Mitra's confession led to a debate about how we needed this pause from real life in order to return to it refreshed and ready to confront it. Yet Mitra's point stayed with me. What about after the pause? Whether we wished it or not, our lives outside that living room made their claims. But it was the fairy tale atmosphere Mitra had alluded to that made it possible for all eight of us to share confidences and to share so much of our secret life with one another. This aura of magical affinity made it possible for Mahshid and Mana to find a way to peacefully coexist with Azin for a few hours every Thursday morning. It allowed us to defy the repressive reality outside the room. Not only that, but to avenge ourselves on those who controlled our lives. For those precious few hours, we felt free to discuss our pains and our joys, our personal hang-ups and weaknesses. For that suspended time, we abdicated our responsibilities to our parents, relatives and friends, and to the Islamic Republic. We articulated all that happened to us in our own words and saw ourselves for once in our own image. Our discussion of Madame Bovary continued way past the hour. It had happened before, but this time no one wanted to leave. The description of the dining table, the wind in Emma's hair, the face she sees before she dies, these details kept us going for hours. Initially, our class hours were from 9 to 12, but gradually they were prolonged into the afternoon. I suggested that day that we continue with our discussion and that everyone stay for lunch. I think this is how we established lunches. I remember all we had in the refrigerator were eggs and tomatoes, and we made a tomato omelette. 2 weeks later, we had a feast. Each one of my girls had cooked something special, rice and lamb, potato salad, dolme, saffron rice and a big round cake. My family joined us and we were all gathered around the table joking and laughing. Madame Bovary had done what years of teaching at the university had not. It created a shared intimacy. During the years they came to my house, they knew my family, my kitchen, my bedroom, the way I dressed and walked and talked at home. I had never set foot in their houses. I never met the traumatized mother, the delinquent brother, the shy sister. I could never place or locate their private narrative within a context, a locality. Yet I had met all of them in the magical space of my living room. They came to my house in a disembodied state of suspension, bringing to my living room their secrets, their pains, and their gifts. Gradually, my life and my family became part of the landscape, moving in and out of the living room during the breaks. Tahira Khanum would sometimes join in and tell us stories about her part of town, as she liked to call it. One day, my daughter Negar burst in crying. She was hysterical. Between tears, she kept saying she couldn't cry there. She didn't want to cry in front of them. Mana went into the kitchen and came back with Tahira Khanum and a glass of water. I went to Negar, held her in my arms, and tried to calm her. Gently, I took off her navy scarf and robe. Under that thick scarf, her hair was damp with sweat. Unbuttoning her uniform, I asked her to tell us what had happened. That day, in the middle of her last class, science, the principal and the morality teacher had barged in and told the girls to put their hands on their desks. The entire class had been escorted out of the classroom without any explanation. Their school bags searched for weapons and contraband, namely tapes, novels, friendship bracelets. Their bodies were searched, their nails inspected. One student, a girl who had returned from the United States the previous year with her family, was taken to the principal's office. Her nails were too long. There, the principal herself had cut the girl's nails so close that she had drawn blood. Negar had seen her classmate after they were dismissed in the schoolyard, waiting to go home, nursing the guilty finger. The morality teacher stood beside her, discouraging other students from approaching. For Negar, the fact that she couldn't even go near and console her friend was as bad as the whole trauma of the search. She kept saying, "Mom, she just doesn't know about our rules and regulations. You know, she just came back from America. How do you think she feels when they force us to trample on the American flag and shout, 'Death to America'? I hate myself. I hate myself," she repeated as I rocked her back and forth and wiped the mixture of sweat and tears from her soft skin. This, of course, diverted the whole class. Everyone tried to distract Negar by joking and telling her stories of their own, how once Nasreen had been sent to the disciplinary committee to have her eyelashes checked. Her lashes were long, and she was suspected of using mascara. "That's nothing," said Mana, "next to what happened to my sister's friends at the Amir Kabir Polytechnic University." During lunch, three of the girls were in the yard eating apples. They were reprimanded by the guards. They were biting their apples too seductively. After a while, Negar was laughing with them, and she finally went with Tahira Khanum to have her lunch. 18. Imagine you're walking down a leafy path. It is early spring, before sundown, around 6 p.m. The sun is receding, and you're walking alone, caressed by the breezy light of the late afternoon. Then suddenly, You feel a large drop on your right arm. Is it raining? You look up. The sky is still deceptively sunny. Only a handful of clouds linger here and there. Seconds later, another drop. Then, with the sun still perched in the sky, you are drenched in a shower of rain. This is how memories invade me, abruptly and unexpectedly. Drenched, I am suddenly left alone again on the sunny path with a memory of the rain. I have said that we were in that room to protect ourselves from the reality outside. I have also said that this reality imposed itself on us like a petulant child who would not give his frustrated parents a moment to themselves. It created and shaped our intimacies, throwing us into unexpected complicity. Our relations became personal in many different ways. Not only did the most ordinary activities gain a new luminosity in the light of our secret, but everyday life sometimes took on the quality of make-believe or fiction. We had to reveal aspects of ourselves to one another that we didn't even know existed. I constantly felt I was being undressed in front of perfect strangers. 19. A few weeks ago, while driving down the George Washington Memorial Parkway, my children and I were reminiscing about Iran. I noticed with a sudden misgiving the alien tone they had adopted when talking about their own country. They kept repeating, they over there. Over where? Where you buried your dead canary by a rosebush with your grandfather? Where your grandmother brought you chocolates we had forbidden you to eat? They did not remember many things. Some memories made them sad and nostalgic. Others they dismissed. The names of my parents, Bijan's aunt and uncle, our close friends, they evoked like magic mantras, joyfully taking shape and disappearing with each utterance. What triggered our reminiscences? Was it the Doors CD that my children were so accustomed to hearing in Iran? They had bought it for me for Mother's Day, and we were listening to it in the car. Jim Morrison's seductively nonchalant voice purred from the stereo. "I'd like to have another kiss," his voice stretched and curved and twisted while we talked and laughed. "She's a 20th century fox," he intoned. Some memories bore them, some excite them, like when they make fun of their mother dancing all over the place from the hall to the living room singing, "Come on, baby, light my fire." They tell me they have already forgotten so much. So many faces have become dim. When I ask them, "Do you remember this or that?" most often they don't. Now Jim Morrison has moved to a song by Brecht. "Oh, show me the way to the next whiskey bar," he sings, and we accompany him on the next line. Oh, don't ask why. Even while we lived in Iran, they, like most kids of their background, had little affection for Persian music. For them, Persian music was identified with political songs and military marches. For pleasure, they turned somewhere else. I was shocked to realize that their childhood memories of songs and films in Iran would be The Doors, the Marx Brothers, and Michael Jackson. They liven up to one memory. This one is surprisingly clear. They fill in all the details I had forgotten. As it comes back to me and images form in my mind, their voices interrupting one another, Jim Morrison fades into the background. "Yes, Yossi was there that day, wasn't she?" They remember my whole class, but Yossi is the one they remember most, because at a certain point, she became so much a part of our family. They all did. Azin, Nima, Mana, Mahshid, and Nasreen were frequent visitors. They used to spoil my children, bringing them gifts despite my disapproval. My family had accepted these intruders as another one of my eccentricities, with tolerance and curiosity. It happened in the summer of 1996, when my two children were home from school. It was a lazy morning. We had puttered about the house and prepared breakfast late. Yossi had stayed over the night before. She did that regularly now, so we came to expect her. She slept in a spare room next to the living room that was supposed to be my office, but it was too noisy for me. I had moved my office downstairs to a basement room with windows opening onto the small garden. It was an odds and ends room with a desk and a very old laptop, some books, my winter clothes, and Yossi's makeshift bed and lamp. Sometimes she spent hours in that room, with the lights turned off because of her headaches. Almost every time she came from a visit to her hometown, she had these headaches. That morning, she looked radiant, I remember. This is how I see her, in the kitchen or in the hall, standing or sitting. I imagine her mimicking some comical professor, doubling over with laughter. That summer, there were many days when Yossi would follow me around the house, telling me stories. Our place was mainly in the kitchen or the hall, and I enjoyed the fact that, unlike the grown-ups, unlike my own children, she actually liked my cooking. She loved my so-called pancakes and French toast, my concoctions of eggs, tomatoes, and vegetables. Never once did she smile, the indulgent smile that my grown-up friends gave me, as if to say, "When will you learn?" As I cooked or chopped, she would move with me and spin stories, mostly about her classes. Negar, who was 11 by then, would join us, and the three of us would talk for hours. That day, Yossi was holding forth on her favorite subject, her uncles. She had five uncles and three aunts. One uncle had been killed by the Islamic Republic, and the rest lived in the United States or Europe. The women were the backbone of the family, the ones on whom everyone depended. They worked at home and they worked outside the home. Their marriages had been arranged at a very young age to much older men, and apart from one of the sisters, Yossi's mother, they all had to put up with spoiled, nagging husbands, inferior to them intellectually and in every other way. It was the men, the uncles, who always held the promise of the future for Yossi. They were like Peter Pan, descending every once in a while from Never Never Land. When they came to her city, there were endless gatherings and celebrations. Everything the uncles said was enchanting. They had seen things no one else had seen, done things no one else had done, and they would bend down and play with her hair and say, "Hey, little one, what have you been doing?" It was a quiet and peaceful morning. I was in my long house dress, curled on a chair in the living room, listening to Yossi's tale about a poem one of her uncles had sent her. Tahir Khanum was in the kitchen. From the open dining room door, we could hear different noises, the sound of running tap water, the thin clink of pots and pans, half a sentence addressed to the children who were in the hall by the kitchen, alternately laughing and quarreling. I remember yellow and white daffodils. The whole living room was filled with vases of daffodils. I had put the vases not on the tables, but on the floor, beside a painting of yellow flowers in two blue vases, also on the floor. We were waiting for my mother's Turkish coffee. My mother made fabulous Turkish coffee, thick, bittersweet, and this served as her excuse for periodic intrusions. At different intervals in the day, we would hear her calling us through the connecting door to our apartment. "Tahere, Tahere," she would call. And she continued calling even when Tahere and I answered her back in unison. Assured that we did indeed want our coffee, she disappeared, sometimes for over an hour. This was my mother's way of communication for as long as I can remember. Curious about my class on Thursday mornings and too proud just to barge in, she used the coffee to gain admittance to our sanctuary. One morning, she quote-unquote accidentally came upstairs and called me from the kitchen. "Do your guests want coffee?" she asked, glancing through the open door at my curious, smiling students. So another ritual was added to our Thursdays, my mother's coffee hour. She soon formed her favorites among my students and tried to create separate relations with them. For as long as I can remember, she would ask perfect strangers to our house for coffee. One day we had to turn away an alarmingly athletic man in his late 30s who had by mistake rung our bell, asking for the lady who had told him to drop by and have coffee with her when he was in the neighborhood. The guards at the hospital opposite our house were her regular customers. At first they would stand reverently, coffee cups in hands. Later, at her insistence, they sat down uneasily on the edge of chairs as they related all the gossip about the neighbors and the goings-on at the hospital. This was how we later learned the details of what happened that day. Yossi and I were waiting for our coffee, basking in the luxury of no special urgency when the bell rang, sounding louder than usual because of the quiet of the street. As the bell rings, one more time in my memory, I hear Tahira Khanum dragging her slippers along the floor, making her way to the front door of the apartment. I hear her footsteps fading as she slowly goes down the stairs to the street door. We hear a few words exchanged between her and a man. She returned rather startled. There were two plainclothes officers at the door, she explained, men from the Revolutionary Committee. They wanted to raid the apartment of Mr. Colonel's tenant. Mr. Colonel was a new neighbor whom my mother consistently ignored because of his newly rich ways and manners. He had destroyed a beautiful vacant garden next to our place and built an ugly, graystone, three-story apartment. He lived on the second floor, his daughter was on the third, and he rented out the first. Tahira Khanum explained that they wanted to arrest Mr. Colonel's tenant, but they couldn't gain admittance to the house, so they wanted to go into our yard and climb over our walls to get into the neighbor's house. We obviously, or perhaps not so obviously, wished to deny them this permission. As Tahira Khanum wisely put it, what good is a committee official who doesn't have a search warrant and can only go into people's houses through their neighbors' yards? They needed no search warrant when it came to barging into decent people's houses at all times, so why were they so helpless when it came to this one particular crook? We had our differences with our neighbor, but we were not about to hand him over to the committee. As Tahira Khanum was relating all of this, there was a commotion in the street below. We heard the sounds of men talking hurriedly, feet running, a car engine starting. We hardly had time to wrap up our criticism of the committee when there was another ring at the door. This time, it was more persistent. A few minutes later, Tahira Khanum returned, accompanied by two young men in the khaki outfits that were then fashionable with the Revolutionary Guards. They explained that they no longer needed our garden wall to jump over to the neighbor's house. The culprit had now jumped into our garden and was armed and hiding there. They wanted to use our balcony and the balcony of the third floor to keep him busy by shooting at him while their colleagues sought to catch him. Our permission was not required, but they were considerate of whom they called other people's wives and mothers, so they asked for it anyway. They let us know by implication and gesture that their prey was dangerous. Not only was he an armed drug pusher, but he had other crimes to his name. Three others who proceeded to march upstairs now accompanied our two intruders. What went through my mind then was, I later discovered, exactly the same thing that occupied Tahir Khanum's. Upstairs, on a corner of the big terrace, we had hidden our large and forbidden satellite dish. Later, we all wondered how it was that our concern was not so much for our lives or for the fact that five armed strangers were using our house for a shooting match with a neighbor who was also armed and hiding somewhere in our garden. We, like all normal Iranian citizens, were guilty and had something to hide. We were worried about our satellite dish. Tahir Khanum, who was more cool-headed than I and knew their language better, was assigned to go upstairs. Yasi was in charge of looking after my two bewildered children, and I accompanied the two men to our balcony, which opened into our bedroom and gave onto the garden below. I remember, in the midst of all the confusion, at one point I thought, what a good story for Yasi's uncles. I bet even they can't top this. The events of that day, even after my children and I thoroughly inspected every detail, are somewhat confused. As I remember it, I seem to be in all places simultaneously. Like the genie in the Aladdin cartoon, one moment I was on the balcony in the middle of crossfire, listening to the committee men threatening the culprit while relating in bits and pieces his sinful history, intimating that he was supported by people in high places, which explained why they had no official search warrant. Next, I was upstairs, assured by Tahir Khanum that the guards were too busy to pay attention to our satellite dish. Later, she told me that the guards had tried to use her as a shield, saying that this man would shoot at them, but not her. In between the shootings, my interpreters of these strange proceedings revealed that were they to succeed in their present enterprise, our neighbor would probably be released by his high-powered patrons. He warned me insistently about the evil nature of this criminal who had now taken cover at the farthermost corner of our garden under the generous shade of my favorite willow. With comical despair, they took to bewailing the hopeless nature of their mission to us, we, who considered both sides equally criminal and intrusive and wanted them both out of our lives as soon as possible. The game now shifted to our other neighbor's house, as his two frightened children and their babysitter took refuge in the street. One of their windows was shattered by the gunfight. The culprit hid for some time in a small tool shed at the end of their garden by the swimming pool, but by now the guards had approached him from several sides. He threw his gun into the swimming pool, why I cannot say, and the scene shifted to the street. We brought the neighbor's two sons into our house. The children, the neighbors and mine, and Yasi and I, leaned out the window to watch the committeemen as they dragged their prey into the back of a white Toyota patrol car, he shouting all the while, calling out to his wife and son, and warning his wife that under no circumstances should she open the door to the house. We did have our coffee in the end that day, as all the participants, Yasi, Tahir Khanum, the children and I, and the guards at the hospital, all gathered in my mother's parlor to exchange stories. The guards gave us the inside scoop on Mr. Colonel's tenant. He was in his early 30s. His arrogance and rough manners had earned him the hatred and fear of the hospital staff. For the past 6 weeks, our street had been under observation by the committee members who had just made their move. We all agreed that this was a factional fight and that the culprit most likely worked for some high officials. That would explain how at such a young age he could afford the exorbitant rent, the opium and the antique cars in his garage. The hospital guards were told he was one of the terrorists responsible for some of the assassinations in Paris over the past 10 years. It was predicted by our self-appointed investigative committee that he would soon be released. As it turned out, these predictions were correct. Not only was he released, but he came to our door one day soon after his return and tried to persuade Tahir Khanum to lodge a complaint against the Revolutionary Committee members who had barged into our house to arrest him, something we did not do. That night, as my husband and I were drinking tea at yet another meeting convened at our neighbor's house, the children, intrigued by the events of the day, decided to inspect all the scenes of the skirmish. In the process, they discovered in the tool shed a small tape recorder in the arrested man's black leather jacket, which he had hidden there. We were law-abiding citizens, and after listening to an incomprehensible conversation about some trucks, we handed the tape recorder and the jacket over to the committee, despite passionate protests from the children. This story was repeated many times, including the following Thursday, when Tahir Khanum and my children, who had by then lost their shy curiosity and with it the necessary decorum to keep them off the premises during my class, reenacted the scene to an eager and smiling audience. It was interesting to see that they, the committeemen, were so helpless, so bungling and unprofessional. As Yasi pointed out, we had seen better action movies. Still, it was no consolation to learn that our lives were in the hands of bungling fools. Despite all the jokes and the power we felt then, the house became a little less secure after that, and for a long time we were startled by the sound of the doorbell. In fact, the bell became like a warning from that other world we had tried to turn into a joke. It was only a few months later when the sound of another bell brought two more committee members to our house. They were there to raid our house and to take our satellite dish away. This time, there were no heroics. When they left, our house was in semi-mourning. My daughter, in response to my admonition about her spoiled attitude, asked me with bitter disdain how I could possibly understand her affliction. When I was her age, she said, was I punished for wearing colored shoelaces, for running in the schoolyard, for licking ice cream in public? All this was discussed in my class the following Thursday in detail. Again, we skipped back and forth between our lives and novels. Was it surprising that we so appreciated invitation to a beheading? We were all victims of the arbitrary nature of a totalitarian regime that constantly intruded into the most private corners of our lives and imposed its relentless fictions on us. Was this rule the rule of Islam? What memories were we creating for our children? This constant assault, this persistent lack of kindness, was what frightened me most. 20. A few months earlier, Mana and Nima had come to me for advice. They had saved some money and had to choose between buying some necessities of life, as they put it, or a satellite dish. They had very little money, and they had saved what little they had from private tutoring. After 4 years of marriage, like many other young couples, they could not afford to live on their own. They lived with Mana's mother and younger sister. I don't remember what advice I gave them that day, but I know that shortly afterward, they bought a satellite dish. They were euphoric about their satellite dish, and every day after that, I would hear about a new American classic they had watched the night before. Satellite dishes were becoming the rage all over Iran. It was not merely people like me or the educated classes who craved them. Tahir Khanum informed us that in the poorer, more religious sections of Tehran, the family with a dish would rent out certain programs to their neighbors. I remember that when I was on a visit to the United States in 1996, David Hasselhoff, the star of Baywatch, bragged that his show was the most popular show in Iran. Mana and Nima were never, strictly speaking, my students. Both were working towards their master's degree in English literature at the University of Tehran. They had read my articles and had heard about my classes from some friends, and one day they just appeared in class. They asked me afterward if they could audit my courses. After that, they attended every hour of every class I taught, as well as my talks and public lectures. I would see them at those lectures mostly standing near the door, always with a smile. I felt their smiles were meant to encourage me to continue talking about Nabokov and Bellow and Fielding, that they were meant to tell me how crucial it was that I should go on doing so at all costs to myself or them. They had met at the University of Shiraz and had fallen in love in large part because of their common interest in literature and their isolation from university life in general. Mana later explained how their attachment was based more than anything else on words. During their courtship, they wrote letters and read poetry to each other. They became addicted to the secure world they created through words, a conspiratorial world in which everything that was hostile and uncontrollable became soft and articulated. She was writing her thesis on Virginia Woolf and the Impressionists, he on Henry James. Mana used to get excited in a very quiet way. Her happiness seemed to come from some unknown depth inside of her. I can still remember the very first day I saw her and Nima in my class. They reminded me of my two children whenever they entered a conspiracy to make me happy. At first, Nima was the more talkative of the two. He would walk beside me, and Mana followed a little behind him. Nima would talk and tell stories, and I'd notice Mana peering past Nima to catch my reaction. Seldom did she ever volunteer herself to talk. It was only after several months, when at my insistence she showed me some of her poetry, that she was forced to talk to me directly and not through Nima. I have chosen to give them rhyming names, although their names sounded different in real life. Yet I was so used to seeing them together, voicing the same thoughts and feelings, that to me they were like two siblings who had just discovered something wondrous in their back garden, a doorway into a magic kingdom. I was the fairy godmother, the mad woman in whom they could confide. While we sorted papers and reorganized my office at home, placing the novels side by side, arranging my notes in different files, they shared stories and gossip from the University of Tehran, where I had held a post years before. I knew many of the people they mentioned, including our favorite villain, Professor X, who nurtured a sophisticated and persistent hatred towards them both, Nima and Mana. He was one of the very few professors who had not resigned or been expelled since I had left that university. In the meantime, he thought, they did not sufficiently respect him. He had developed an efficient way of solving all of the complicated problems of literary criticism. He put all matters of interpretation to a vote. Since the voting was performed by a show of hands, debates tended to be resolved in his favor. His principal quarrel with Mana and Nima was sparked by a paper Mana wrote on Robert Frost. At the next session, he informed the class about his various disagreements with her thesis and asked them to vote on the matter. All of the students, except for Mana, Nima, and one other, voted for the professor's views. After the vote, the professor turned to Nima and asked him why was he such a turncoat. Was it perhaps because his wife had brainwashed him? The more he questioned them and put their ideas to vote, the more obstinate they became. They brought him books by prominent critics that supported their ideas against his. In one outburst of anger, he expelled them from his class. One of his students had decided to write his thesis on Lolita. He used no sources, had not read Nabokov, but his thesis fascinated the professor, who had a thing about young girls spoiling the lives of intellectual men. This student wanted to write about how Lolita has seduced Humbert, whom he called an intellectual poet, and ruined his life. Professor X, with a look of thoughtful intensity, asked the student if he knew about Nabokov's own sexual perversions. Nima, with ripples of contempt in his voice, mimicked the professor, shaking his head sadly and saying how, in novel after novel, we find the lives of intellectual men being destroyed by flighty females. Mona swore that he kept throwing her poisonous glances as he embarked on his pet subject. Yet, despite his views on Nabokov's flighty young vixens, when this man had been looking for a new wife, his main condition had been that her age should not exceed 23. His second wife, duly recruited, was at least 2 decades younger than he. 21. One Thursday morning, so hot that the heat seemed to have permeated the cool of our air-conditioned house, 7 of us were talking aimlessly before the class began. We were talking about Sanaz. She had missed class the preceding week without calling to explain, and now we didn't know if she would come again. No one, not even Mitra, had heard from her. We were speculating that maybe the troublesome brother had hatched a new plot. Sanaz's brother was by now a constant topic of conversation, one of a series of male villains who resurfaced from week to week. Nima tells me, "We don't understand the difficulty men face here," said Mana, with a hint of sarcasm. "They too don't know how to act. Sometimes they act like macho bullies because they feel vulnerable." "Well, that is to an extent true," I said. "After all, it takes 2 to create a relationship, and when you make half the population invisible, the other half suffers as well." "Can you imagine the kind of man who'd get sexually provoked just by looking at a strand of my hair?" said Nasreen. "Someone who goes crazy at the sight of a woman's toe. Wow," she continued. "My toe as a lethal weapon." "Women who cover themselves are aiding and abetting the regime," said Azin with a defiant flourish. Mahshid remained silent, her eyes targeting the table's iron leg. "And those whose trademark is painting their lips fiery red and flirting with male professors," said Mana with an icy stare, "I suppose they are doing all this to further the cause." Azin turned red and said nothing. "How about genitally mutilating men?" Nasreen suggested coolly, "so as to curb their sexual appetites." She had been reading Nawal al-Sadawi's book on brutality against women in some Muslim societies. Sadawi, a doctor, had gone to some length to explain the horrendous effects of genitally mutilating young girls in order to curb their sexual appetites. "I was working on this text for my translation project."
"Your translation project?"
"Yes. Don't you remember? I told my father I was translating Islamic texts into English to help Mahshid. But I thought that was just an excuse so that you could come here," I said. "It was. But I decided to do these translations for at least 3 hours a week, sometimes more for the extra lies. I reached a compromise with my conscience, she said with a smile. I have to tell you that the Ayatollah himself was no novice in sexual matters, Nasreen went on. I have been translating his magnum opus, The Political, Philosophical, Social, and Religious Principles of Ayatollah Khomeini, and he has some interesting points to make. But it's already been translated, said Mana. What's the point? Yes, said Nasreen. Parts of it have been translated. But after it became the butt of party jokes, ever since the embassies abroad found out that people were reading the book not for their edification, but for fun, the translations have been very hard to find. And anyway, my translation is thorough. It has references and cross-references to works by other worldies. Did you know that one way to cure a man's sexual appetites is by having sex with animals? And then there's the problem of sex with chickens. You have to ask yourself, if a man who has had sex with a chicken can then eat the chicken afterwards? Our leader has provided us with an answer. No, neither he nor his immediate family or next-door neighbors can eat of that chicken's meat. But it is okay for a neighbor who lives two doors away. My father would rather I spent my time on such texts than on Jane Austen or Nabokov, she added rather mischievously. We were not startled by Nasreen's erudite allusions to the works of Ayatollah Khomeini. She was referring to a famous text by Khomeini, the equivalent of his dissertation required to be written by all who reached the rank of Ayatollah, aimed at responding to the questions and dilemmas that could be posed to them by their disciples. Many others before Khomeini had written in almost identical manner. What was disturbing was that these texts were taken seriously by people who ruled us and in whose hands lay our fate and the fate of our country. Every day on national television and radio, these guardians of morality and culture would make similar statements and discuss such matters as if they were the most serious themes for contemplation and consideration. It was in the middle of this scholarly discussion, peppered with loud laughter on Azin's part and increasing moroseness on Mashid's, that we heard the sound of screeching brakes, and I knew that Sanaz was being deposited by her brother. A pause, a car door slamming, the doorbell, and a few moments later Sanaz entered, the first words on her lips, an apology. She seemed so distraught at being late and having missed the class that she was ready to burst into tears. I tried to calm her down, and Yossi went into the kitchen to bring her tea. She held a big box of pastries in her hands. What's this for, Sanaz? It was my turn last week, she said lamely, so I brought it this week instead. I took the pastries from her hand. She was sweating, and she uncoiled her black robe and scarf. She had tied her hair tightly behind her ears with a rubber band. Her face looked naked and forlorn. Finally, she took her usual place beside Mitra, with a big glass of ice water in her hand and her tea stationed in front of her on the table, and we all waited in silence to hear what she would say. Azin tried to break the silence with a joke. We all thought you'd gone to Turkey for your engagement party and forgot to invite us. Sanaz attempted a smile and took a sip of water instead of responding. She seemed to want to at once say something and reveal nothing. There were tears in her voice before they became visible in her eyes. Her story was familiar. A fortnight earlier, Sanaz and five of her girlfriends had gone for a 2-day vacation by the Caspian Sea. On their first day, they had decided to visit her friend's fiancé in an adjoining villa. Sanaz kept emphasizing that they were all properly dressed with their scarves and long robes. They were all sitting outside in the garden, six girls and one boy. There were no alcoholic beverages in the house, no undesirable tapes or CDs. She seemed to be suggesting that if there had been, they might have deserved the treatment they received at the hands of the Revolutionary Guards. And then they came with their guns, the morality squads, surprising them by jumping over the law walls. They claimed to have received a report of illegal activities and wanted to search the premises. Unable to find fault with their appearance, one of the guards sarcastically said that looking at them with their Western attitudes... "What is a Western attitude?" Nasreen interrupted. Sanaz looked at her and smiled. "I'll ask him the next time I run into him." The truth of the matter was that their search for alcoholic beverages, tapes and CDs had led to nothing, but they already had a search warrant and didn't want it to go to waste. The guards took all of them to a special jail for infractions in matters of morality. There, despite their protests, the girls were kept in a small dark room which they shared the first night with several prostitutes and a drug addict. Their jail wardens came into their room two or three times in the middle of the night to wake up those who might have dozed off and hurled insults at them. They were held in that room for 48 hours. Despite their repeated requests, they were denied the right to call their parents. Apart from brief excursions to the restroom at appointed times, they left the room twice. The first time to be led to a hospital, where they were given virginity tests by a woman gynecologist who had her students observe the examinations. Not satisfied with her verdict, the guards took them to a private clinic for a second check. On the third day, their anxious parents in Tehran, unable to locate them, were told by the concierge at their villa that their children might have been killed in a recent car accident. They set off at once to the resort town in search of their daughters and finally found them. The girls were then given a summary trial, forced to sign a document confessing to sins they had not committed and subjected to 25 lashes. Sanaz, who's very thin, was wearing a t-shirt under her robe. Her jailers jokingly suggested that since she was wearing an extra garment, she might not feel the pain, so they gave her more. For her, the physical pain had been more bearable than the indignity of the virginity tests and her self-loathing at having signed a forced confession. In some perverse way, the physical punishment was a source of satisfaction to her, a compensation for having yielded to those other humiliations. When they were finally released and taken home by their parents, Sanaz had to deal with another indignity, her brother's admonitions. What did they expect? How could they let six unruly girls go on a trip without male supervision? Would nobody ever listen to him just because he was a few years younger than his scatterbrained sister who should have been married by now? Sanaz's parents, although sympathetic to her and her ordeal, did have to agree that perhaps it had not been such a good idea to let her go on the trip. Not that they did not trust her, but conditions in the country were unsuitable for such indiscretions. "On top of everything else, I am now the guilty party," she said. "I've been deprived of the use of my car and am being chaperoned by my wise younger brother." I cannot leave Sanaz and her story alone. Time and again I have gone back to it. I still do, recreating it bit by bit. The garden fence, the six girls and one boy sitting on the veranda, perhaps telling jokes and laughing. And then they come. I remember this incident just as I remember so many others from my own life in Iran. I even remember the events people have written or told me about since I left. Strangely, they too have become my own memories. Perhaps it's only now and from this distance when I'm able to speak of these experiences openly and without fear that I can begin to understand them and overcome my own terrible sense of helplessness. In Iran, a strange distance informed our relation to these daily experiences of brutality and humiliation. There we spoke as if the events did not belong to us. Like schizophrenic patients, we tried to keep ourselves away from that other self, at once intimate and alien. 22. In his memoir, Speak Memory, Nabokov describes a watercolor that hung above his bed when he was a young child. It is a landscape, an image of a narrow path disappearing into a forest full of trees. His mother read a story to him about a boy who disappeared one day into the painting above his bed, and this became young Vladimir's wish as he prayed every night. As you imagine us in that room, you must also understand our desire for this dangerous vanishing act. The more we withdrew into our sanctuary, the more we became alienated from our day-to-day life. When I walked down the streets, I asked myself, are these my people? Is this my hometown? Am I who I am? Neither Humbert nor the blind censor ever possesses his victims. They always elude him, just as objects of fantasy are always simultaneously within reach and inaccessible. No matter how they may be broken, the victims will not be forced into submission. All this was on my mind one Thursday evening after class as I was looking at the diaries my girls had left behind with their new essays and poems. At the start of our class, I had asked them to describe their image of themselves. They were not ready then to face that question, but every once in a while, I returned to it and asked them again. Now, as I sat curled up on the love seat, I looked at dozens of pages of their recent responses. I have one of these responses in front of me. It belongs to Sanaz, who handed it in shortly after her jail experience at the seaside. It is a simple drawing in black and white of a naked girl, the white of her body caught in a black bubble. She's crouched in an almost fetal position, hugging one bent knee. Her other leg is stretched out behind her. Her long, straight hair follows the same curved line as the contour of her back, but her face is hidden. The bubble is lifted in the air by a giant bird with long, black talons. What interests me is a small detail as opposed to the more obvious imagery of the girl. The bubble and the girl's hand that reaches out of the bubble and holds on to the talon. Her subservient nakedness is dependent on that talon, and she reaches out to it. The drawing immediately brought to my mind Nabokov's statement in his famous afterword to Lolita about how the first little throb of Lolita went through him in 1939 or early 1940 when he was ill with a severe attack of intercostal neuralgia. He recalls that the initial shiver of inspiration was somehow prompted by a newspaper story about an ape in the Jardin des Plantes who, after months of coaxing by a scientist, produced the first drawing ever charcoaled by an animal. This sketch showed the bars of the poor creature's cage. The two images, one from the novel and the other from reality, reveal a terrible truth. Its terribleness goes beyond the fact that in each case an act of violence has been committed. It goes beyond the bars, revealing the victim's proximity and intimacy with its jailer. Our focus in each is on the delicate spot where the prisoner touches the bar, on the invisible contact between flesh and cold metal. Most of the others express themselves in words. Mana saw herself as fog moving over concrete objects, taking on their form but never becoming concrete herself. Yasi described herself as a figment. Nasreen, in one response, gave me the Oxford English Dictionary's definition of the word paradox. Implicit in almost all their descriptions was the way they saw themselves in the context of an outside reality that prevented them from defining themselves clearly and separately. Mana had once written about a pair of pink socks for which she was reprimanded by the Muslim Students Association. When she complained to a favorite professor, he started teasing her about how she had already ensnared and trapped her man, Nima, and didn't need the pink socks to entrap him further.